5 seconds left, he waved the ensign quiet. But he found his tongue stymied. All the usual Vaden words invoked the Emperor, and that would be too ridiculous an epitaph for Laurent Zai. "Thank you for your service," was all he managed. Zai sighed, waiting. The time passed. It must have. "The shot missed us," the captain said quietly. The sensor officer stared into his heads down in disbelief. "Not an accidental miss, sir. They changed their targeting, attacked a debris field 6 kilometers away, tore it to pieces." "But why?" Zai stammered. "It was lit up, sir. Some heat, microwaves, and a high-strength transmission." "Transmission?" "An Imperial SOS, a personal beacon." Zai shook his head. It was too much to believe. A diversion at the right moment. A member of the Lynx's crew had somehow wound up out there, kilometers away, and had died for the ship. But who? "They had us, sir," the sensor officer continued. "Why would they go for anything else? It was only a few sparks out there, relative to the hit they'd put on us." "We were too easy," Zai said. "Too obvious. Hobbs's transmission was too blatant. They must have thought that we were the decoy." A tremble began in the ship, a low moan that rose and fell. "They're targeting us now, sir. Switch their fire from the debris to the Lynx. But we're outside effective range. The gravity cannon is at half charge, wide aperture. 5,000 gravitons per." Zai sighed. Barely enough to give a man skin cancer. He could feel the weapon's passage with his sensitive inner ear, a mild nausea at worst. "Give me internal diagnostics," he ordered, "and order the crew to remain in pressure suits." The frigate was unstable, and the low-intensity chaotic gravity bombardment might continue for a while, growing ever more diffuse as the ships drifted apart. Again, they had survived. 10 years earlier, Imperial Absolute. House. Over many decades, the house had grown in all directions. Though perched on a mountain peak, it extended deep enough into the mantle of home to draw geothermal power. Now that summer had arrived, the views from 6 balconies revealed gardens and artificial waterfalls all the way to the horizon. The house had littered neighboring peaks with outpost colonies of self-sustaining butterflies, their mirror wings reflecting sunlight to keep plants alive and water flowing, cast artful shadows, and bring the pale reds of the Arctic sunset to 360 degrees of vista. Its processors were everywhere, buried in the rocky passages of the mountain, backed up in rented remote locations, distributed across the snows for 100 kilometers. Between polar isolation, the senatorial privilege of its mistress, and its vast size, the house was a world unto itself. And yet a certain anxiety haunted the house today, a sense of inadequacy and self-doubt that ran like a subtle tremor through its teraflops. A new situation had arisen, one that it had considered and modeled for decades but never experienced. For the first time, there were 2 people here at once. The mistress had a guest. The house scanned the underground food gardens, the special supplies brought in by suborbital for the lieutenant commander's visit, the emergency stores that had lain untouched for a century. It tallied, of course, far more food than 2 people could eat in 4 years, much less 4 days. But the disquiet remained. This visit was the house's chance to show the mistress what it had accomplished over lonely decades of abandonment, to display the results of its long independent expansion program. Dinner was already planned, the steamy growing levels just above the geothermal plant raided of produce for a tropical banquet. Fermented plantains had been basted with relish of green tamarind, cabbage pickled and formed into delicate flower shapes, then flash-fried in a microsecond plasma field. A species of brine shrimp that purified the house water supply simmered for hours in caramel. A pudding of sticky rice and palm sugar blackened with coconut ash to match the lieutenant commander's naval uniform. And to clear the palate, 20 milliliters of vodka to end each course had been infused with lychee, rambutan, papaya and mangosteen in turn. But perhaps this was too much, the house now despaired. The rules of etiquette were clear. The last dinner of any visit should be the grandest, not the first. With Laurent Zai staying longer, it would have to outdo itself 4 more dinners in a row. And what if the mistress changed her mind again? No amount of processor power, no number of contingency plans, no acreage of machinery, Nothing was sufficient to withstand human caprice at its worst. What were they talking about now? The house returned its attention to where the mistress stood with the newly promoted Captain Lawrence Zai. They were on the western balcony, holding each other, looking out at a trio of small peaks capped with patterns of algae-reddened snow, just now struck with the slowly setting sun. Quite a composition, the house thought smugly. The mistress was still smiling from the kiss they'd shared after she had invited him to stay. 4 days seems so little, Nara, Zai said. The house disagreed. 12 meals to create, 4 sunsets to compose. We can make them last.
I hope so.
His eyes fell to the garden of insect-shaped ice sculptures below.
We've so many technologies for making absolute time pass quickly. Stasis, relativistic travel, the symbiont. But none to make a few days seem longer.
The mistress laughed. I'm sure we'll think of something. She moved closer.
You already have?
Yes, I have.
Perhaps dinner can wait.
The house followed their progress to the bedroom, mutely appalled. Senator. As the summer's brief night fell across the room, Nara Oxman thought to herself, an entire day without apathy. It had been too long. She needed more of these respites from the capital, needed to set her mind completely free of the drug without the crowd coming in. She looked at Lawrence's dozing form. Perhaps she needed a measure of madness every now and then. After the rush of the first few minutes, the effects of apathy withdrew gradually, Nara's empathy gaining in strength over the slow hours. Her ability had been active all day, moving and adjusting itself, slowly growing comfortable with the man next to her, settling across the pattern of his thoughts like a blanket of snow over one of the house gardens. Lawrence seemed to have recovered his balance in the hours since telling her about Dantu. She could feel his mind aligned by the sureties of his grey religion, his military discipline. Although Lawrence's touchstone sprang from convictions alien to Nara, there was comfort in anything that took away his pain. Nara wondered if this was a good idea, letting herself bond so strongly with someone she hardly knew, who was by any measure a political enemy. Who would be gone so soon, for so long? Lawrence stirred. A fire? She asked. They left the bed and opened up the north wall to the pink night sky and the Arctic chill. Nara loved the high Arctic summer. The sun hid behind the mountains but never lost its grasp on the horizon. She wondered what it would be like in half a year when daylight rather than darkness lasted only 1 hour and 10. They chose split dry logs for the fire, building it high and hot enough to push them back a few meters, counterpoint to the chill night air on their backs. When Lawrence slipped away to maintain his prosthetics, Nara asked the house to salvage what it could of dinner and to deliver it here. It responded a bit stiffly. Knowing that Grays didn't approve of talking machines, Nara had ordered it to keep silent in Lawrence's company. She wondered if the house's conversational package needed more practice than it was getting on her infrequent visits. When Lawrence returned, he was dressed. She wrapped herself in bedclothes. After a silence, she felt his discomfort. He was unsure what to say. This moment always eventually came with new lovers, in those quiet moments between dramatic turns. What would the pink senator and the grey soldier talk about? No point in fighting the obvious. Do you really think there'll be another incursion, Laurent? He shrugged, but she felt trouble in him. Until today, I had my doubts about the rumours, but this posting to Legis, right on the frontier... Isn't most of the Navy on one frontier or another?
True.
But I'm to take command of a new kind of warship. He paused and looked at her. But that's classified, of course. He smiled. You're not a Rick spy, are you? Nara laughed. Laurent, in a few weeks I'll be on the intelligence sub-quorum of His Majesty's Senate. You'd better hope I'm not a Rick spy. His eyebrows shot up.
You're on the Oversight Committee?
Lawrence's alarm flared in her empathy and turned quickly into reflexive withdrawal. Nara could feel the revulsion that military culture held for civilian interference. If that's what you call it in the Navy, yes. He took a deep breath.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Did you think secularists never took an interest in the military?
An interest, certainly.
But not necessarily a positive one.
My interest is very positive, Lawrence. The Emperor's military forces benefit from oversight by the living, I'm absolutely sure. We're the ones who do the dying for him, after all. He grimaced, the phantoms of his lost limbs twisting painfully, and she could almost hear his thoughts. What did she, a pink senator, know of dying? My assignment may come before the committee, he said flatly. Perhaps we should restrict our conversation. Oxen blinked, marveling again at how politically naive military officers could be. Laurent hadn't even bothered to check her portfolio before coming. Her own handlers wouldn't let her attend so much as a cocktail party without memorizing a detailed history of every person on the guest list. After inviting him here, she'd researched Zai's commanders and former crew, his academy standings, and had digested reams of apparatus propaganda about the hero of Dantu. She'd even dipped into the gutter media, the channels who called him the Broken Man. Of course, that didn't mean she understood him. In all that detail, Nara had missed one salient point: the length of his career in real years. After almost a century absolute of serving the Emperor, decades passing at relativistic speeds, the man was tired of losing friends and lovers to the time thief. And now he would be gone for another 20 years at least. He had every right to be angry. But not at her. She put a hand on his arm and turned away to look into the fire. Laurent, I don't want to restrict anything we say to each other. But I don't care about the Emperor's secrets. I just asked because I want to know when you're coming back. He sighed. As do I. They were silent for a while, staring into the flames. Nara wondered why she had pressed him. He was probably right. They shouldn't be sharing classified information across the lines of political and military, democratic and imperial pink and grey. But somehow she needed to cross the boundaries of their alien hierarchies now in these early days. Otherwise they never would. She wanted to be trusted, even though she was a pink. Perhaps it was as simple as that. Nara felt the change in him before he spoke. He wanted something, too. I know you're not a spy, Nara, and I'm sure your committee will hear about it soon enough, so you should hear it from me. They've given me a new kind of ship, a frigate prototype. Everyone knew you'd get a command, Laurent, a reward for your faithful service. Perhaps. But any prototype wants battle testing. They wouldn't be sending a ship like the Lynx to the Rick's frontier if there weren't some promise of action there. Nara nodded, feeling the certainty in him, and the dread. She was too young to have lived through the incursion herself, but could always feel the icy memory of Rick's terror attacks in those who had. Whole cities razed by gravity weapons. Planets reduced to pre-terraformation by bombardment from space. Even the grey places of the dead attacked, the bodies of the risen deliberately sundered beyond the ability of the symbiont to repair. It's a small, fast ship with hitting power and range, he continued. A deep raider, a way to strike back against the Ricks. I see, she said softly, squeezing his non-prosthetic arm. That would mean going even farther outward, wouldn't it? Her empathy with Laurent remained strong. She felt him sifting thoughts so cold that she couldn't name them. What was he thinking? 10 more years out, he said. Plus years of raiding if it comes to war. So you really meant it that you might be gone 50 years? Yes, 50. An entire senator's term. Of course, with Nara in stasis most of the year and Laurent's time frame stretched out by relativity, it might only be a decade subjective for them both. Still a vast separation, given that she'd hardly known him 2 days. Why, she wondered, was it always most terrible being separated from someone you'd just met? It's not only the years, Nara. The fact that I'm a pink? That I'll be slashing your budget while you're at the front? He barely smiled. No, it's what I'll do out there. That grey Vaden charm again. Laurent, I can hardly expect fidelity. I didn't mean... Nara, I'm talking about what I'll do as a soldier, what the Lynx is designed to do. Make war? You've done that before. You served in the Dantu occupation, after all. I can't imagine anything worse. He turned to her, still full of blackness, and spoke with effort. I can. She quieted herself, letting her empathy work. It was very small inside him, hard to see clearly, a dark place. Then she found a way in, and it hit her. worse than his memories of the tortures he'd suffered on Dantu, more sovereign. It was a black abstraction, cold potential, like the mind noise on a vast hold street corner in the calm just before a political riot, the kind in which people would die. Nara Oxum's empathy recoiled, her head suddenly spinning, some animal part of her mind knowing ahead of the rest what her empathy would show. But he kept talking. The Lynx is a deep raider, Nara. Long-range killing power, fast and expendable. Unbidden, true telepathy came with a glimpse of what he imagined. Rolling satellite imagery, fields and rivers from space, the grid of a city coming into view. Against the Ricks, he continued, we won't be hitting shipping and logistical targets. The Lynx is made to do what we never managed in the first incursion, to take the war to the Ricks worlds. Laurent, this grey man knew the mechanics of it. He understood the horrific details of how it would be done. As they brought war to ours. Stop! As she said it, Nara's hand went to her wrist, searching for the apathy bracelet. But she'd taken it off when they'd arrived. She was defenseless against his thoughts. In any event, he said it out loud. My ship is for killing worlds, Nara. She swallowed something acid, stood up, and went onto the balcony. The rail caught her hands, and she pulled herself up from stumbling. Breathed deeply. The cold cleared her head. This helplessness was absurd. House. Yes, mistress? It whispered in private, second hearing. Get me my bracelet. Priority. Done. Laurent was beside her. Nara? I'm sorry. You would have heard anyway. It's just withdrawal from my counter-empathy drug. I'm sorry. He held her, pressed close to warm her. She could hardly feel the dark thing in him now. Godspite. Where did he hide it? It's nothing, Laurent. It happens sometimes when I come out here. In the capital, I have to take it for the crowds. But here I forget. He sighed. I understand. He knew she was lying. Laurent. Yes. She saw something moving, a house-serving drone, skittering down the handrail, clutching her apathy bracelet. She took another deep breath, her panic receding at the sight of it. Will you do it? Nara reached out and took the bracelet from the drone. Laurent clutched her shoulder and she tasted his struggle, the fight against his conditioning, his upbringing, his own grey soul, against a planetary landscape rolling beneath him, virgin and defenseless. I hope not, he said. Her fingers closed around the bracelet and the drone backed away, but Nara didn't activate the flow of apathy yet. Don't, she asked. He looked behind him as if the Emperor might be listening from the bedroom, but it was just more servos, a small army of them arranging things in front of the fire. In the flickering light, they looked like mad insects building a miniature city. Laurent's eye nodded quietly and whispered, all right. I won't. I promise you. 4 days to make promises, he had said an hour ago. Nara slipped the bracelet onto her wrist, unused, and swallowed. Godspite, her mouth was dry. Dinner, then? She said. 2. Alchemical. Above all, a soldier must be willing to die. Anonymous 167. Commando. The second rendezvous went considerably better. Hurd successfully jumped from the recon flyer to the dirigible, and over a few hours it lifted her to approximately 80 kilometers altitude. The commando looked down over the entanglement facility. From this height, it was smaller than a palm at arm's length. The dirigible's vacuum sphere had quadrupled in size during the slow ascent. Hurd pressed her face to a rebreather tank. The decline in pressure during the ascent had been considerable. Her ears were ringing and she'd felt a blood vessel burst in one eye after an hour of climbing. A Ricks commando could take a wide variation of air pressure, but this was the lowest she'd experienced since hull breach training. There was no weather up here in the mesopause, but it was unbelievably cold. The ablative suit, recovered like the rebreather from a supersonic aircraft emergency store, was insulated enough to keep her from freezing. Hurd found, however, that she missed her sable coat. Well, she would be warmed up soon enough. The positioning device in her hand beeped Alexander's signal to her. It was almost time to drop. The entanglement facility seemed off-center to her, but the compound mind had carefully calculated the wind direction and speed. With a strangely un-Rick's thought, Hurd hoped that Alexander hadn't made any mistakes. She had to hit an area roughly 10 meters across after a fall that would take more than 20 minutes. Alexander had used its weather satellites to find the snowdrift, which filled a 30-meter deep glacial rift inside the array's defensive wire. The compound mind had introduced a few nanos disguised as snowflakes into its cloud-seeding efforts. These had fallen into the drift and doped the snow. Over the last few days, the nano colony had changed the structure of the ice crystals, expanding the drift, leaching carbon from the soil for structure, and creating a colloidal foam that would compress smoothly when Hurd struck it. The snow had swelled up into a hill that rose 10 meters above the surrounding landscape. Thus, Hurd's fall would be broken gradually over almost 40 meters. Of course, she had to hit the trench dead center. She held the positioning device firmly in her free hand. It would guide her to the target area. Hurd prepared herself, swallowing to adjust the pressure in her ears. She checked the straps of her mission pack. Then the dirigible motors cut, the signal to drop. She unlocked the muscles in her hand that clung to the dirigible's payload basket and slipped into the void. Weightless again, freefall was an old friend. The rush of air built slowly, worsening the cold on the unprotected parts of her face. Her ablative suit was designed to fight fires on board aircraft. A few nanos, programmed by Alexander and delivered through a medical pack, had altered it sufficiently to make it invisible to Imperial radar. Or so Alexander's models predicted. She rolled into a ball, protecting the positioning device and watching its numbers move. The altimeter showed her to be still accelerating. Terminal velocity for a human was about 60 meters per second on Legis. As close as Hurd could estimate by the rolling altimeter, her speed had passed that. Probably the air up here was thin enough that terminal velocity was noticeably higher, and she would actually be braking as she descended into higher pressures. After 5 minutes of falling, warmth began to bloom in the suit. It grimly crossed her mind that she was heating up from re-entry friction. But Hurd dismissed the thought. She couldn't be going that fast. The temperature increase was just the heat trap of the stratopores. After 10 minutes total of falling, the air gradually began to grow cold again. She was passing through the stratosphere, approaching the cold air of the tropopores. Extending her arms slowly, Hurd began to take control of the descent, slowing herself and angling toward the entanglement facility, now as big as a dinner plate, below her. She swallowed constantly to keep her ears clear and watched the numbers on the positioning device roll as she angled her free hand and legs to guide her fall. Her coordinates seemed only incrementally closer to the target. Of course, she was a few minutes from entering the tropospheric wind currents that would push her toward the target snowdrift. Hurd had low orbit jumped once in training, but that was with a purpose-built Rick suit, parafoil, and artificial gravity backup. The situation was somewhat different when wearing a retrofitted improvised Imperial suit and landing in a pile of snow. It wasn't the equipment that had her nervous, though. She had faced death at every stage of this mission. It was nothing short of fantastic that she had survived this long. But Hurd had realized during these relatively quiet minutes of freefall that Rana Harta had stolen some of her courage. Hurd found that she wanted to live, a strange desire for a Rick's commando. Perfect, she thought. To encounter fear for the first time while falling, at 60 meters per second and without a parachute, into a heavily guarded enemy facility. Love, Hurd said bitterly. The rampant wind tore the word from her mouth without comment. After 15 minutes had elapsed, the longitude and latitude on the positioning device began slowly moving toward the target values. The tropospheric wind was pushing her toward the landing area, and it was getting warmer again, moving toward the merely freezing temperatures of the polar surface. The entanglement facility was now visibly increasing in size from moment to moment. The sensation of falling became less abstract. Hurd finally saw the ground rushing toward her. She extended hands and feet and angled her body, swooping to bring herself closer to the target area. The positioning device finally beeped. She had matched the snowdrift's coordinates. The commando could see it below her now, the winding, snow-filled rift reflecting starlight with pale luminescence. From aerial photographs supplied by Alexander, Hurd had memorized the exact spot she needed to hit. She tucked the positioning device into her pack and began counting down. The altimeter read 6,000 meters, 100 seconds to go. She swallowed fiercely now as air pressure built, cupping her hands to guide herself gently to the target over these last few moments. Invoked by a mental command, her body went through an impact preparation sequence. She expelled the air from her lungs completely, let her muscles relax, rebalanced the ratio of strength and flexibility in her plastic ligaments to favor the latter. By the time her internal count had reached 8 seconds, Hurd was physiologically ready for impact. The deepest part of the trench lay directly below her, no farther than looking down from the top of a medium-sized building. At 0.5 kilometer and falling, details on the ground gained focus rapidly. Rocks and a few scrub bushes became visible, and the moiré weave of a retransmitter dish's arc scintillated in one corner of her vision. After 20 minutes of falling, it was odd how quickly the snowbound earth was rushing up at her. 5, 4, 3. The surface of the altered snow broke with a pop as she crashed through. She later realized that a thin layer of frost had formed over the nano-doped snow. This brittle crust of rime was at most a centimeter thick, and probably couldn't have supported more than a few grams of weight. But at 60 meters per second, it packed a punch. Like the surface of water at high speed, it had for a moment the force of concrete. The impact broke Hurd's nose and split her lower lip and opened a bleeding cut over her right eye. But then she passed into the colloidal pseudo-snow, which caught her in its foamy arms, slowing her descent. The Rixwoman came smoothly to a stop. She opened her eyes in total darkness, her head ringing from the impact of breaking the crust. Testing each muscle and joint in turn, she found herself to be uninjured except for the insults to her face. She sat up, orienting herself in the darkness of the cold, compressed foam snow around her, and looked upwards. The sky was just visible through the 20-meter-deep hole she had made. Her own outline, almost comically exact, showed for a few moments before the foam snow began to collapse, covering her. Hurd breathed deeply and fast, storing oxygen before she was enveloped by the foam. She would remain here motionless for 30 minutes or so. The impact shock of her landing would have registered on the facility's motion sensors, but if she stayed still, the snow-muffled momentary vibration would read as simply a cleaving of the snowdrift, an event well within the natural stochastic rumblings of the Arctic wild. The darkness covered her. After the rushing air, especially the frigid layer of the tropopause, the foam snow brought a blanket of warmth. Hurd felt blood dripping into her eye from her cut and tended to her wounds as she waited. That brittle crust of ice represented a small error in Alexander's plan, she noted to herself, the sort of hairline mistake that was magnified 1,000-fold in a mission of this difficulty. No system, not even a compound mind, was perfect. A very un-Rixwoman thought, but true. After she'd waited the requisite time, the commander began to tunnel out of the drift. She kept an eye on the positioning device, not trusting her own magnetoreceptor direction-finding cells this close to the pole. Her oxygen reserve was limited, and any wrong turn that led her into an unclimbable wall could be deadly. It would be rather banal to drown in this foam after surviving an 80-kilometer fall. The nano-doped snow was strange stuff. In the readout light of the positioning device, she could see the tiny bubbles that made it up, composed of water structured by large carbon molecules. The substance seemed dry when touched gently, but under shock it disintegrated into a wet, somewhat slimy substance. In her hand, the bubbles broke down quickly into water. Even her low body temperature was sufficient to disrupt its stability. When the warm winds of spring came, all evidence of how this trick had been performed would be gone forever. Hurd reached the edge of the foam and climbed from the trench into a drift of real snow. She raised a periscope through the crust first and surveyed the area. There was no sign of an Imperial response to her landing. She pulled herself from the drift and dusted snow and foam from her. The ablative suit had torn on impact, and a few icy trickles of water already numbed her feet. The Rixwoman crawled away from the landing zone, careful to keep her distance from the area of doped snow. Anyone stepping on that part of the drift would plummet to the bottom of the trench, softly but ignominiously. There were also vibration sensors to be wary of. Hurd moved slowly and haltingly, an uneven motion designed to mimic natural processes. The commando searched the horizon for the telltale glimmer of microwave arrays. The threads of the offline repeaters glowed like spiderwebs all around her, the nearest 30 meters away. With her painstakingly slow and interrupted crawl, it took Hurd 5 minutes to traverse the distance. The main portion of the device was roughly the size of a fist. From this central mass radiated the microwave receiver array, the slender filaments that gathered the civilian communications of Legis bound for translite transmission. The transmitter stick rose from the center of the fist, a decimeter high and